State Player on 720 WGN. There is a brand new book out there called Chicago, America's Railroad Capital, the first illustrated history of the people, machines, facilities, and operations that made Chicago the hub around which entire continent's rail industry still revolves. And joining us to share the story is longtime railroading author and photographer Brian Solomon. Good morning to you, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent, excellent. Thanks for joining us this morning. Great book, by the way. You know, and it's funny, we were driving around today, and my 2-year-old son just is so fascinated by trains at every age. I think you still are, because, you know, there's such a large history in Chicago. And you break down this great book by four chapters, the first one being the Chicago's railroad history. And in the very beginning, Chicago had the canal, which dates back to the early 1830s. And it all started here with the Galena and Chicago Union Railroad launched by our first mayor.
That's right.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, what I wanted to talk about is the book and how it came about. And it's really the work of not just myself, but three other co-authors.
Okay.
And they're a really important part of the book. Mike Blazak, who wrote the history, which you just alluded to in the beginning, is one of the world's best authorities on railway history and operations. And he lives in Chicago. He's lived in the Chicago area all of his life, and he's really focused on the history. And he really is able to put together and distill all the bits and pieces that you'd want to know about the different railroads very, very quickly. And then the other authors are Chris Guth and John Gruber. John Gruber is fairly well known in railroad circles. He's the founder of the Center for Photography and Art in Madison, Wisconsin. He writes for Classic Trains. He was the editor of Vintage Rails, and I've worked with him for 20 years. Chris Guth is an expert on modern railway operations, freight, passenger, locomotives. He's a correspondent for Trains Magazine. And myself and these three guys all took a look at Chicago from different angles. So it's kind of four stories on Chicago that gives you a complete picture of how the city came about railroad-wise and what it means yesterday and today, with maps and lots of photos. And we all take pictures, and we love watching trains, and we love experiencing the railroad, you know, as it happens.
Oh, it's great to see a lot of the travel posters and all the artifacts that are in there as well. But I want to talk a little bit, you know, I just want to touch upon the history part of this. It was launched by our first mayor, which was the Galena and Chicago Union Railroad. It was used to carry hogs and wheat initially. It wasn't about passenger railroads. It was about service.
Yeah, and actually a lot of American railroads were really about moving freight. The fact that they happened to carry passengers was usually, in the beginning, you'd run some excursions and you kind of tolerated passengers because communities along the lines would kind of expect you to do that. But the real money was always in moving freight. Now, some of the Chicago railways developed suburban services because as they move forward, they realize, well, there's money in moving people too. So they would move suburban services. And, of course, they had long-distance trains. And in my chapter, I talk about the long-distance trains and the passenger terminals because long-distance trains, especially the name trains, were always great for advertising. And don't get me wrong, back in the day, railroads did make a bit of money running, especially the long-distance trains. But as things move forward, freight was really the emphasis. And that's one of the things that makes Chicago tick today is all the big freight railroads in North America all converge on Chicago and exchange freight with one another, as well as serving customers in the greater Chicago area. And that interchange means you've got freight yards and locomotive terminals and all of that, which, you know, it's a huge thing for employment and it's a huge node for commerce.
What was fascinating to me, Brian, in the early days here is that, you know, the railroads all led to Chicago, but there were these little, I mean, there were smaller railroads. You know, we talked about the Galena and Chicago Union Railroad. There was the St. Charles Airline. There was the Chicago Aurora. There were just a lot of little competitors out there branching off really into the suburbs at the time, in the early days.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things about how railways in America formed is they were, for the most part, private companies from the get-go. And like you said, they were small companies going from, you know, Chicago to Galena or Chicago to Burlington, that sort of thing, right? You know, they went from, you know, maybe a few hundred miles. And then as time progressed, they rapidly formed into bigger systems. So, you know, the Chicago and Galena became part of another system. The Chicago and Burlington became part of the Burlington system. You know, all these big systems kind of formed. You had the Chicago Northwestern, you had the Santa Fe, you had the Milwaukee Road. And over time, those big railroads, were what we know as the Class Ones, they started merging in the pretty much after World War II, but really in the 1960s and 1970s, the big railroads started merging and forming even bigger railroads. And now you're down to really six huge railroads, Norfolk Southern, Union Pacific, CSX, et cetera. And there's these huge big companies that are all across North America, yet they still focus on Chicago. Except for the two Canadian railroads, Canadian National and Canadian Pacific, the big American railroads still go to Chicago, but not beyond it.
And I'm jumping ahead a little bit here, but it's amazing from all these smaller railroads, railroad companies that existed and then branched out and then kind of formed into other companies, that there's only a half dozen left. My aunt Janet Plyer worked for Soo Line Railroad, I think for 40 or 50 years. In Schiller Park, and I remember going and visiting her over there, and you know, I still have a lot of Soo Line memorabilia, and it was about a year and a half ago, and I remember she used to always travel to Minneapolis for business, and they were based, I believe, in Minneapolis, weren't they, Soo Line?
Yes. Yeah. They were a subsidiary or an affiliate of Canadian Pacific, and still are.
Yeah, and the building where their offices were, that I think my aunt always used to go to, is now has been converted into this entertainment complex and hotel. But it has, I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's called the Depot, and it has all this railroad history in there. And I only realized after I stayed there the first time that this is where my aunt went all the time for these Soo Line meetings. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, well, that's neat. The Soo Line was a really pretty neat railway. And the funny thing is, it's one of the ones that still exists on paper. It's part of Canadian Pacific.
Right.
And the Canadian Pacific image prevails over Soo Line. But really, the Soo Line still exists. And it took over the Milwaukee Road in the 1980s and 1985. Oh. So a lot of what was Milwaukee Road, which, of course, one of Chicago's great railroads was Milwaukee Road. And, I mean, I'm always really partial to Milwaukee Road because they operated some of the fastest steam power trains ever conceived. I mean, in the 1930s, their Hiawatha running up to Milwaukee in the Twin Cities would routinely hit 100, 110 miles an hour with steam locomotives on every day. It did that to maintain its schedule. And people talk about high-speed rail, and I remind them, we used to have high-speed rail. We just forgot.
Right, exactly, right. Well, which we'll get to in a little bit here. You know, back to the 1800s, the railroad business was obviously attracted to the Union stockyards. I mean, we had to get our hogs and our meat out of here somehow.
Yeah, well, and the stockyards were huge. It's one of those things that, you know, as time moves on, people don't realize how big a deal some of these industries were. But the railroads, as they moved into the Great Plains, you know, and as we settled, you know, the Midwest and then the plains in the far west, the railroads conveyed animals from everywhere to Chicago for meatpacking. And that was a huge part of the railroad business, was bringing live animals to Chicago for slaughter. And then, you know, then the conversion of those products into meat that were then transported everywhere else in the country. And it's one of the things that allowed America to grow so quickly, was our ability to produce food to feed everybody and get it to where it needed to be before it spoiled.
And it was rail.
You know,
absolutely.
Yeah, it was the railroads made America. And I don't know if a lot of people realize that. It's completely true. I mean, if you, especially anywhere, you know, across the Midwest or the West, if you follow the railway lines, you see where the population is.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Where the towns are. These railroads go, you know, this is where all those little towns where they were built around the railroads. Absolutely. Now, on a whole other level, tell us about the George Pullman legacy.
Well, Pullman was an interesting guy. He was the first one to take the sleeping car concept and make it practical. He wasn't really the first guy to do a sleeping car, but he was the first one to get into the business and do railroad sleeping cars. In other words, you could sleep on the train and make it reasonably comfortable. And his Pullman Palace Car business was based in Chicago, and he got into the business of not just running the Pullman cars themselves, but manufacturing the Pullman cars. And it was an interesting concept, because he built the cars and he ran the cars on the train. So you, the railroad, would contract Pullman to operate the sleeping car. And then he got into building all kinds of other cars. I mean, the Pullman name is huge in railroad freight cars and passenger cars. But he had, in this kind of Victorian era, this paternalistic fantasy where you would have a city and, you know, the company would be everything for the employee. And he believed if you provided good housing and a good working environment, and it was during the time of temperance, and you shouldn't allow your workers to drink, because of course then they wouldn't be able to, you know, perform properly.
Sure.
So he had this kind of very idealistic view of employment. And Unfortunately, it really wasn't all that practical, and I think probably what, about 1891, 1892, I'd have to check the date in the book, but there was an enormous Pullman strike, and it was a very violent strike, and sadly, he died pretty much. I mean, the strike basically killed him, but I mean, he was fairly elderly at that stage, yeah. And that changed everything. But the Pullman Company, continued to run the sleeping cars until after World War II, and continued to build passenger cars. They were the biggest producer of passenger cars for most of the early 20th century.
Amazing, amazing. Then there were Chicago's passenger terminals and trains. When did we see the first of those, the passenger terminals?
Well, I'd have to actually check the date. It's one of those things. There's hundreds of dates in the book. And
I know Grand Central was about 1890, and the Union Passenger Depot opened in 1892, and then, of course, Union Station was in 1925. But, you know, passenger trains started becoming a little bit more common. Was it the mid-1800s or the late 1800s?
Well, pretty much from the beginning, there were passenger trains. Mm-hmm. What happened is, as America started to move more, there were, a lot more passenger trains. And so the first few terminals would have been very simple affairs. You know, it probably been, one or two tracks and a few platforms. And then as you're running more and more trains and more railroads are coming to Chicago, so you have a lot of times, one railroad would come in via another or offer another railroad in its facility, so they wouldn't have to have, each railroad wouldn't have to have its own passenger station. So you had, like, LaSalle Street would have served, say, New York Central and Rock Island, and Union Station served the Pennsylvania Railroad and its affiliates, plus the Alton and the Milwaukee Road and the Burlington. And starting around the late 1890s, early 20th century, they started building bigger and newer terminals. And at that time, a railroad terminal was the face of the railroad, and you couldn't just have a utilitarian building. You had to do something to make it look a little bit nicer. So Grand Central, for example, would have been one of the nicest looking stations. And then, Union Station, built in the 1920s, would have been the last of the big stations. Probably, in my estimation, probably one of the nicest stations would have been Northwestern Station, which was also the railroad company headquarters, Chicago Northwestern. And that was, really designed to put the face of the railroad forward, right? To show people, mm-hmm. Look, this is what we are. This is, we're not just a railroad. We're really important here.
Was the passenger trains, were they a little bit more rudimentary? Were they very basic at the time? Like, when did they start becoming a little bit more luxurious and a little bit more glamorous to travel?
I'd say probably starting in the 1880s, 1890s, when they started putting sleeping cars and dining cars on, mm-hmm. and the railroad started getting a little more competitive. The trains certainly got much nicer. Now, writers such as Lucius Beebe, who kind of focused on the golden age of rail, would have said that, the golden age of passenger cars would have been up through the end of the wooden era. In other words, the cars used to be made of wood, and they were, especially the first class cars, would have been finely finished with, inlaid interiors and very, very plush accommodations, and the first class trains would have been really, really nice. And then when they went to first steel framed cars starting about 1905, and then all steel cars after 1910, they did that for safety reasons. As train speeds started increasing, if you had a collision with a bunch of wooden cars, they would tend to crumple and splinter and catch fire, and that caused a lot of problems. So they started making all steel cars. But I mean, as you got into the 20th century, I mean, passenger train travel, especially to Chicago, remained very important, and the trains were very nice, for most of the 20th century. Starting in the 1930s, you got into the streamline era. The Union Pacific, yeah. The Burlington were two of the earliest ones to build streamline trains, and that caught on very quickly.
And they were cool looking, too.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm just doing a book on streamliners now, but the streamliners were really, really kind of changed things. And what happened is in the 1920s, the automobile caught on, and to a much lesser extent, airplane for long distance travel. So by the 1930s, because of the Great Depression, the railroads were suffering a real decline in passenger travel, and started introducing the streamliners to get people to travel again. And again, the Milwaukee Road's Hiawatha would have been one of those, the Burlington Zephyr, and most of your big railroads all would have introduced streamline trains.
You know, there's a Galena and Chicago's Union, their first steam locomotive. It was the Pioneer, and I that's probably one of the highlights in the Museum of Science and Industry. It was put into service October 10th, 1848. It's been moved around till 72. Or no, I'm sorry, it's the Chicago History Museum. That is probably one of the coolest things to see, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that's really neat. And in the Chicago Museum of Science and Industry, you have the original Burlington Zephyr.
That's what that
and
is. Okay, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that's the streamline train, 1934. And they restored that in 1995 up in Wisconsin. And I have pictures of them when it was undergoing its restoration. And it's stainless steel. It was built by Budd in Philadelphia. And they actually had a bunch of those trains. That's the original one. But Burlington had a whole fleet of those trains, and they would have run Chicago Twin Cities, and there was some other runs out in the Midwest that they would have run on. But again, that was a really kind of classic train. I just wanted to mention to your readers, I mean, I do railways full time. I mean, that's what I do, is I mm-hmm. write about railways and I mm-hmm. photograph them. And I do a photo blog on the net. It's called Tracking the Light. If you put in Brian Solomon, Tracking the Light, every day I put up a thing, and I talk about, you know, what I do personally, and I talk about the railroad, and I talk about photo history. Often have topics relating to Chicago and Chicago's railways as well.
Very cool. Very cool stuff. And then, of course, you know, I mean, now we're talking about a lot about its history and the past, but today, just as important in the city of Chicago, I mean, obviously, we're still moving stuff on trains every day. I build I build retail store fixtures, a lot of them during the week, and a lot of it comes on rail to Chicago as well. But it's even though the industry is so much more condensed, as you said, to six major companies at this point, I mean, it's still very prevalent in the city of Chicago and across America.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a misconception that the railway industry is in decline, and that couldn't be more untrue. I mean, especially now, the railway industry is booming. There's a lot of things driving it. People don't realize it, but the railways are carrying more now than they ever did. I mean, they might be down a little bit from the peak in 2008, but I'd have to check the figures. But, I mean, certainly in 2008, they were carrying more than they ever had ever before. And then, of course, the whole economy kind of contracted a little bit. But, I mean, the myth is that railroads peaked in World War II and then they declined till the present. And that's completely untrue as far as the freight's concerned. Now, the passenger trains in general declined very rapidly after World War II. So by 1971, there was just a skeletal network of the intercity passenger trains, which Amtrak took over. And, of course, Chicago benefits from an excellent suburban service run by Metra.
Absolutely.
I'm sure a lot of your listeners are very familiar with that. And Metra does a great job. But Metra is, you know, a composite of a lot of other railroads' suburban services. So the Burlington, the Milwaukee Road, the Rock Island, their suburban services are all now operated by Metra.
And you know what's funny is my kids, we were about a block from the train. They, you know, we have family up in Barrington. We get to the city all the time, depending on what the weather's like. They love going on the train. They'll do that any day over sitting in the car and, you know, watching their iPads and their, they love sitting in there and they love the experience. So, I mean, it's very multi-generational as well, of course.
Well, I've always found that kids in particular are tuned into railways. I mean, that's how I got into it. When I was a kid, I was tuned into railways. But a few years ago, I was traveling in Poland, and at the time, they still had steam engines in Poland. And I was curious to see how people who were around the steam engines every day reacted to them. And what I found is when, you know, riding on the steam train, and again, this is a train that goes by every day. It's mm-hmm. not a special. It's not unusual. It's the same train they've always seen. When we'd pass villages, little kids and old men would always turn their head.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
And it's just like, there, look, there's the steam engine. You know, it's just something that grabs you, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you, amazing photos. I love seeing the travel posters and all the artifacts. Again, the great photos in this book over the years and then in operation today. And this is just a sneak peek, folks, into this glorious book about our railroad history. It's a great gift for the holidays. Chicago, America's Railroad Capital, is available at Amazon.com. or wherever books are sold. And where can folks find you again, Brian?
Again, I can be found on Tracking the Light. And again, it's a play on railroads and photography. So track is, you know, railroad track, Tracking the Light. And so briansolomon.com, Tracking the Light. And then the book is published by Voyager Press, which is part of the Quarto Group. So if you go to the Voyager Press, there's something called the Q Bookshop. You can see that they hit a number of other railway books, including some other ones that I've worked on as well. And they sell the books, and like you said, via Amazon. And it's a great book. I think anybody that has an interest in Chicago history, not just for the railroads, but it's a book about Chicago and, you know, Chicago and the railroads kind of grew together. So if you're curious to know more about, you know, about the city and about its railroads and about its transportation, and if you just like great photos, I mean, we worked with a lot of different photographers to try to pick the best images that really conveyed what the different eras were about and what the trains were about and the different railroads. And I think people will be really happy with it. It's a nice book. I'm very pleased with it.
It's a beautiful book. Chicago, America's Railroad Capital. Brian, thanks so much for sharing your stories this morning.
Thanks again. Cheers.
All right. Have a great day.